Thanks for tuning in to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. The following is the second part of a two-part essay chat on an article called Fern Seed and Elephants. If you listened to the previous show, then you know this occasional series of essay chats devotes the entire program to a single shorter work by C.S. Lewis. Typically, my essay chats are not in two parts, but because of the length of this material by Lewis, I felt it easily justified the treatment, and additionally, because I originally designed the essay chat to be no more than 10 minutes each. Returning as guest today is Reggie Gates, a Lewis enthusiast who hosts his own podcast show called All About C.S. Lewis. You can find it online at allaboutcslewis.com. Remember to stop by EssentialCSLewis.com for links mentioned in the show, which include a place to purchase the book that contains this Lewis essay. Essential C.S. Lewis is a feature partner site on the Middle Earth Network.
Well, now, some people may not know this. I think I mentioned this to you, Reggie, but you are indirectly responsible for me doing my podcast. I remember finding your site and thinking, why didn't I think of that? using some of my previous professional experience in radio, that's not what I do now. I decided to get my feet wet with what's known as a C.S. Lewis Minute and then decided to try to do some interviews. But anyway, all that aside, again, the essay is Fern Seed and Elephants, also known in some copies that are the most available in print that I'm aware of as Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism. This was first given as a talk in 1959 before some theology students. While last time I noted it can be found in Christian Reflections, there's a shorter collection that also is actually in print called The Seeing Eye, and the essay is available there as well, and it's under the title The Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism. If you're curious about why it's called Fern Seed and Elephants, you're going to have to mostly listen to the first part. But previously we dealt with three of the 4 points Lewis made regarding some liberal theologians' approach to the Bible and what Lewis thought about that. The fourth and final part, which is the main focus of our chat today, is the longer one, so we'll take some time with that here. But first, Reggie, let's start off by having you briefly give us the 3 points.
Lewis's first point is that many modern critics seem to have majored in minors, if you will, in that they claim to be able to read between the lines of the New Testament, seeing fern seeds, small, tiny things, but they lack the critical facility to read the actual lines themselves. They claim, for example, that it's impossible to reconstruct the personality of Jesus from the text. But thousands upon thousands of readers would strongly disagree. They would say that the New Testament presents Jesus in such a manner as to be real, to be personally knowable. That's the elephant, the major elephant that the critics seem to miss. The second criticism he makes is that the modern approach seems to assume that the meaning of the New Testament events were lost or distorted by the early church, and has been only recently recovered by these modern critics. In effect, they were saying, we're the only generation fortunate enough to have people who really understand what the texts really mean. I've seen the critics pour scorn on folks like me, saying that I only want the old way of understanding the Bible and that I reject anything new. My response is that being new doesn't mean that it is true, and I think Jack would agree. The third point is that the critics have an unconscious assumption that the miraculous never occurs. Therefore, for example, Jesus walking on the water didn't occur, but is being used symbolically to represent some inner truth that the writer wants to express. How do we know this? We know this because walking on the water would be a miracle, and we know the miracles never occur now, nor have they ever occurred in the past. Lewis points out that this assumption about the miraculous is a philosophical assumption about the texts, not something that the theologians learn from the texts. And we can differ from them on philosophical grounds. Jack certainly does.
Lewis's fourth and final point, which we've noted already, is his the way he puts it in the essay itself, is his loudest and longest. This is where he is critical of those who make, and I'm quoting here now, attempts to reconstruct the genesis of the text it studies, which in this case is the biblical text. As a place to dive in, how do you think Lewis kicked it off by using an example in his own life?
Well, this approach is associated with a German phrase, Sitz in Leben, which I loosely translate as life situation. The question is, they believe that they can go back and determine what caused the text to be written this way. Lewis begins by looking at some works of his that have been reviewed, starting out, in this case, with an early book of essays. Of all the essays, the one that he liked the best and the one that he really put a lot of time and effort in was one on William Morris. The very first reviewer that looked at his book said that this essay was obviously the one where Jack had no interest in the subject. And no doubt the reviewer proceeded to tell why Lewis felt no interest in William Morris. That is, the reviewer here didn't critique what was written, but attempted to tell what situation or experience of the author produced the essay. And the reviewer was wrong, completely wrong. Now, this caused Lewis to be especially attentive to this approach in other reviews that he read, both of his works and works of his friends, and he found, and he claims in his essay, that this Sitz and Leben technique of reconstructing texts was always incorrect. It was 100% failure. Jack illustrates this with an example from The Lord of the Rings by his friend J.R.R. Tolkien. Do you remember the One Ring to Rule Them All found there in the trilogy? When the trilogy was first published, many reviewers said that it was obvious that the ring was suggested to Tolkien by the atom bomb. Here, the atom bomb was a weapon. It's madness to throw it away, but it's fatal to use. And that's just like the One Ring. But Jack knew the chronology of the trilogy that Tolkien wrote, and that chronology made the atom bomb theory impossible. Based on this, I think Jack suggests that we ought to pay polite attention when a scholar reconstructs the history of how and why a particular gospel passage was written. Afterwards, though, we should take the scholar's reconstruction with a large grain of salt. The scholar, after all, wasn't there and doesn't really know.
Well, now, towards the end of the essay, Lewis turns to, of all places, math for his support. Tell us why this is a little funny and what he actually says.
Well, to me, it's funny because math was Jack's absolute worst subject. In fact, it nearly kept him out of college. So it's unusual to see him turn to math for support. You always wonder how he's going to do in his calculations. That said, he points out that most of us are familiar with what's called Peter's Great Confession, when he confesses that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Now, one of the founders of this modern approach, the mythological approach to biblical criticism, says that this confession is an Easter story projected back into time. Lewis points out that this assumes, first, that Peter's confession did not occur. Then it adds other assumptions to this to explain how and why the confession was developed and then inserted into the story by the author at this point. Jack points out that what we have here is a hypothesis stacked upon the top of a hypothesis stacked upon the top of another hypothesis. In fact, there's a stack of all these assumptions and guesses. Now, mathematically, to calculate the probability of all of them being true, we have to multiply the probability of each hypothesis together. Thus, if they all individually have a 90% probability, we find that a stack of hypotheses too high has an 81% probability, while a three high stack has a roughly 73% probability, if my math is correct. Jack points out that in a complex reconstruction, like we have here in Peter's Confession of Christ, although each guess has a high probability of being true, perhaps, the probability the whole stack drops rapidly towards zero. Most of these reconstructions of the gospel elements are of a complex nature, and therefore of a low probability, in Jack's opinion.
Yeah, indeed, it is. It is ironic, since math was his worst subject, and it is kind of funny. But speaking of funny, despite the seriousness of this subject, what do you think? I found that Lewis used humor quite a bit in this essay. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, if you read the essay, you'll see that it's a very learned essay. You can see the people he references, philosophers as well as other modern theologians. So he's widely read. But there's also that wonderful vein of humor that I think Jack always has. I think Jack promotes to me what is a robust and genial Christianity, and his humor is a big part of his appeal, at least for me. And this essay is no exception. He leaves no doubt as to where he stands and why. That is, it's fully robust in terms of his position and his opinion. But he tempers this with a genial, humorous approach. I wish we could have more of that in our writings and speakings today. I think it would present a more winsome face to the world.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Now, final question. How do you find for today? Do you think this essay is useful? And if so, why?
Oh, absolutely. That's why it's one of my favorite essays. Now, you may have never read by a book by one of the scholars from the Jesus Seminar. I did try one once, and I made it almost halfway through and gave up. But you might have heard of a book called The Da Vinci Code and a movie by the same name. That same Jesus Seminar approach to the Bible is taken in the book and the resulting movie. In the book's view, we, that is, a group of modern scholars, are the only ones smart enough to recover the code and understand what the Gospels really mean and what really happened. The approach Jack criticized some 60 years ago is there in the popular culture, and we must be able to respond to it. To me, this essay gives us some tools to do that. Of course, we don't want to get into endless, almost dreary debates about the truth of Scripture. We can admit, as Lewis does, that there are some questions, and indeed there's some discrepancies between the gospel accounts of Christ's life. But on the other hand, we must insist that we have a complete and true picture of Jesus that presents God in Christ in all his appealing love and glory to everyone who will just read the New Testament.
Ah, well put. Well put. Now, in terms of quotes, I've got a couple of quotes that, you know, it's such a great essay, and there's a lot of things that could be picked. For me, a couple that I want to share is, I'm quoting here, "The idea that any man or writer should be opaque to those who lived in the same culture, spoke the same language, shared the same habitual imagery and the unconscious assumptions, and yet be transparent to those who have none of these advantages is, in my opinion, preposterous." That's when he's making his second point. And then towards the end of the essay, he notes, "You cannot know that everything is the representation of a thing is symbolic unless you have independent access to the thing and can compare it with the representation." Kind of a complex thing. I'm not sure right now, as I'm just sharing the quote, I fully grasp that, but it really stood out when I was reading it. What are a couple quotes that you especially enjoyed?
Well, this quote is sort of the introduction to the fern seeds and elephants idea. It places this discussion of the modern theologians and refers to them this way. "These men asked me to believe that they can read the lines of the old texts. Their evidence is their obvious inability to read, in any sense worth discussing, the lines themselves." And I think that really does apply to a lot of the theologians who do biblical criticism today and in Lewis's day. The other quote comes towards the end of the essay when he's addressing the students. And he says that he is talking about agnosticism, due agnosticism towards the biblical critics. And he says, "For agnosticism is, in a sense, what I am preaching. I do not wish to reduce the skeptical elements in your mind. I am only suggesting that it need not be reserved exclusively for the New Testament and the creeds. Try doubting something else first."
Yes, very good, very good. Now, just briefly here, what are some related essays that people who like this type might find interesting as well?
Very quickly, there are two essays. One is Miracles, and the other is The Grand Miracle, which both discuss the historical probability, the historical existence of miracles, especially in the New Testament. And then there's the book Miracles Itself. You can get those two essays in the book collection God in the Dock. And then finally, if you are interested in this way of biblical criticism and how it developed, there's an old book, about 30 years old, that is very sound still, and it's written by a different author, by a gentleman named William Barclay. It's called Introduction to the First Three Gospels. And I think that if you wish to really get into it, that would be a good book to study. It is fairly scholarly and well footnoted and referenced. But if that's one of your interests, you'd certainly enjoy it.
Okay, great. Well, again, this has been a two-part discussion on the essay Fern Seed and Elephants, also known as Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism. Reggie Gates has been my guest. His website is a good one to check out. Again, it's allaboutcslewis.com. Thanks again, Reggie, for being with me.
Thanks again for having me, and it's been a pleasure to record this essay with you.